Good evening. I'm the director of the V&A, Martin Roth. I'm delighted to welcome so many of you here this evening to the 5th Robert H. Smith Annual Lecture, which is part of a 10-year program of educational events generously funded by Robert H. Smith. We are particularly pleased that Laurice and Michelle Smith are with us this evening. Welcome. It's my privilege to extend a warm welcome to our speaker, Professor Patricia Rubin, whose lecture will undoubtedly not only play a strength to the V&A's exceptional sculpture collection, but challenge our perception of some familiar sculptures. We are also delighted that Professor Rubin will be joined in conversation with the renowned artist Anthony Gumley, who will bring his particular sculpture insight into this intriguing topic. Welcome, Anthony Gumley. Since 2009, Professor Patricia Rubin has been the Judy and Michael Stanhart Director of the Institute of Fine Arts at the New York University. Her numerous publications are a range of Renaissance artistic productions, include the books Giorgio Vasari, Art and History and Images, and Identity of the 15th Century Florence. Before returning to the United States, she was for many years one of the leading lights of the art historical world here in London as a professor of the Italian Renaissance art at the Courtauld Institute and the founding head of the Courtauld Institute Research Forum, which makes this lecture a forum for homecoming. Please join me in welcoming her to speak us now. Thank you.
Good evening. I am greatly honored by the invitation to give this year's Robert H. Smith Lecture on Renaissance sculpture, doubly so by the fact that it has been conceived as a conversation with Anthony Gormley, and slightly daunted by that. Before I start, I really also must offer my thanks to my hosts here, but also to my colleagues at the Institute of Fine Arts, particularly Jason Verone and Lauren Jacoby, who helped me gather tonight's images. Not always an easy task, as will be one of my topics, the question of seeing coming from behind, viewing the male nude in Italian Renaissance sculpture. In thinking about this evening's lecture, I decided to take Mr. Gormley at his word, or rather to take his words and his works as a point of departure. And I show you here as a title slide, this is a sculpture called Two Times by Anthony Gormley from 1997 or 1997 installation. Reading his essays and reflections, I was struck by the historical definition that he makes between classic works, as he calls them, and his own sculpture. In the classic, he says, or he has written, the economy between the sculpture and the viewer went in one direction, and feelings of awe, desire, and changing notions of the beautiful were in some way objectified in sculpture. Whereas in the contemporary, there is an energy flow that goes in the opposite direction, in the feelings and experiences that sculpture somehow provokes in the viewer. He has posed the problem of the figurative as phenomenological or experiential, stating that sculpture is about how we might understand our own embodiment in both space and time. He contrasts body as representation with body as space. He has also noted how the idealized gods, as he calls them, of the sculptural tradition are traditionally viewed. Oops. There we are traditionally viewed on plinths, and here one of our gods, resulting in an easy equation of elevation and elevated value. Elevation, which I can add, tends or intends to determine perspectives and direct viewpoints. Anthony has further pointed out that these positions are power plays, products and expressions of privilege controlled by its hierarchies of viewing and organization of spectatorship. Prompted by these observations, in what follows, which is about half an hour of speaking before we begin our conversation, and maybe Anthony will want to contradict everything I've said about what he said, but we'll learn that in due course. Anyway, I will consider these questions, what these statements raise about the making, meaning, and beholding of sculpture at a time when those activities were actively being discussed. Where Mr. Gormley can declare the end of the era of representation, I'm going to explore its origins, or rather the origins of its articulation from modern art history in a consciously formed critical language and in carefully planned installations. My chosen vantage point, that of the male behind, may seem eccentric, but it serves as a striking reminder of the dimensionality of those works and the dimensional concerns of their makers, which I will argue have been largely denied through the conventions of their presentation and representation over time. That is to say that Renaissance statues have often been placed spatially and historically in perspectives that favor the frontal and the pictorial. While this forward-facing viewpoint recognizes important qualities of their design, or disegno, so highly valued in Renaissance theory of the arts, it neglects the full implications of form. Now, it is true, admittedly, that it is not always easy to take bottoms seriously. If you seek to study the longer history of the behind, particularly the male behind, you will often find it in undignified positions, signifying the barbaric, the comic, the lowly, or the cruel. So, the wittily placed web-footed monster at the bottom of a page in a mid-13th century psalm book, that's the image on your left, in the British Library, the Rutland Psalter, whose ass is pierced by the tail of the letter P from conspectu, which means to set before the eyes, so you're really being able to really see it in this way. Or, on the right, the bent-over peasant laboring in the fields in the month of September in the Duc de Berry's Très Riche Heure. Dante, for his part, made the bottom a diabolical motif, in the 21st canto of his Inferno, where the devil Malacoda, evil tale, rouses his rowdy band of followers, the nasty britches, the malebranche, by making a trumpet of his ass, his culo, as this is how it's pictured by Sandro Botticelli in his illustration of the canto. There are literally dozens of insults and curses involving bottoms in Italian, colloquial expressions that really can be heard in our times as well as Dante's. It is no coincidence, I think, that backsides feature conspicuously in iconographies of humiliation, where flagellators and executioners are regularly shown from the back or with prominent buttocks. As here in Donatello's flagellation in the terracotta altarpiece in this museum, and there I show you the flagellation where Christ turns his back and the flagellator showing his behind. It's quite typical of this iconography. In these contexts, the back view could be called a villainous view, providing a way to figure brute force with bulging back muscles and tensed arms and legs, while also suggesting the brutishness of that force. The backside of Bronzino's, the mid-16th century painter, Bronzino's monstrous double-sided portrait of the dwarf known as Morgante, both confirms and contemplates and complicates these negative associations. I use the term monstrous advisedly. According to the definitions of the time, dwarves were classified as monsters, creatures formed outside the usual course of nature. They were avidly sought and collected as curiosities by the leading courts. Morgante, whose given name, whose actual name as a person, was Braccio di Bartolo, was the favorite among six dwarfs at the court of Duke Cosimo de' Medici. A constant companion to the Duke, he served the Medici from the mid-1540s until his death sometime before 1584, when he was celebrated in a poetic epitaph. That service is recorded by an extensive iconography, painted and sculpted, comic and semi-serious. Morgante was depicted participating in court ceremonial, as here in the foreground of Giambologna's bronze relief, showing Cosimo's coronation as the Grand Duke of Tuscany on the base of his equestrian monument. That is Cosimo's, not Morgante's. And you see him kind of egging on a fellow courtier in the ceremony. As I say, it's a kind of semi-serious position within the court. And once Morgante figured as part of court festivities as a table ornament made of sugar, commissioned from Giambologna's studio in 1608 for the wedding of Prince Cosimo I to Maria Maddalena of Austria. There's a story that the leftover sugar sculptures, which obviously no longer survive, the person from Giambologna's studio, Pietro Tacca, who was responsible for them, kept them until 1630 when there was a plague in Florence. He had to leave Florence, but he was aware of the fact that his assistants might become hungry and therefore leave, taking with them the secrets of the studio. So he mixed them with wine and water and served them all to keep them happy during this difficult time. Anyway, that was a Morgante. One disappeared Morgante. Morgante was the name of a giant, the hero of a popular mock epic poem. Bronzino's life-size portrayal of the dwarf with the accoutrements of a bird hunt partakes of this burlesque tone. An unidealized nude in a noble stance, the picture is unsparing in its observation, and I think somewhat ironic in its tone. It is a monument to a midget, life size, and it is a midget who is likely to have hunted birds for the Duke's amusement, as well as once winning 10 gold scudi for his victory in a naked wrestling match with a monkey. So the portrayal of the nude Morgante partook of real life amusements involving these monsters, these dwarfs. The painted is documented among the Duke's possessions in a 1553 inventory of the palace. It was located in a densely furnished terrazzino, but probably it must have been an enclosed terrace. It was included among other portraits and kept company with maps, cityscapes and landscapes, a Virgin and Child, also by Bronzino, precious stones, ancient statues, and a broken clavicembalo, among other things. Ill-sorted as its contents might seem, the enclosed terrace was actually a repository of valued items. It was on the route of visitors to the palace. The Duke was an eager collector of the wonders of nature as well as of art, seeking out zoological and botanical specimens with a passion for what was then called natural philosophy. Bronzino's careful depiction of the anatomy of the dwarf and of two species of owl, the gufo on the front side and the civetta on the back, of the canvas, the jay in flight on the front, and the monarch butterfly covering Morgante's genitals corresponds to these pursuits, his pursuit of natural history. Native to the region, all of these specimens also correspond to Cosimo's promotion of things Tuscan, including the Florentine language, where birds and owls constitute or provide lewd puns on nude, on male sexual organs, their size and their proclivities. Familiar innuendos, as they say, very Tuscan, used by Bronzino in his own raunchy comic poems and probably in this picture. There's a number of not so hidden lewd jokes here. The double-sided picture with its double entendres is also an academic demonstration of the painter's skill. Academic in that it relates to the learned culture promoted at Cosimo's court, not only natural philosophy, questions of language, but referring directly to the debate on the relative merits of the arts of painting and sculpture. In 1546, Benedetto Varchi, the leading scholar of the court, solicited letters from painters and sculptors on this question, including one from his friend Bronzino. 2 years later, in 1548, Varchi delivered a series of lectures on the subject, reflecting on the responses he had received and appraising the matter philosophically and historically. The general conclusion was that the two were united as arts of design. The aim of both was to master the difficulties of imitating nature for the delight of knowledgeable beholders and to give pleasure for the grace and ingenuity of their compositions. The debate did not begin with Varki, nor did it end with him. Many gave painting the edge in this debate, which is the nobler of the two arts, citing the manual labor involved in sculpture, which would make it more mechanical, and the universality available to the painter through the depiction of subtle and transient effects, such as the bird's feathers and the fluttering butterflies in Bronzino's picture. The number of viewpoints available to one art or the other was also a key issue in this debate. Showing the recto and the verso of the figure, Bronzino used Morgante as his answer to what painting could do, while the sculptor Benvenuto Cellini offered numbers varying from 4 to 40 viewpoints for statues, thereby adding exponentially to both the difficulties and the merits of his art. Leonardo da Vinci, like Bronzino, asserted that these so-called continuous and infinite views could be satisfactorily reduced to 2, front and back, so long as they were correctly juxtaproportioned. John Bologna, who more than once made the nude Morgante the subject of his art, manifestly did not agree with the two-sided proposition. A bronze Morgantino cast in 1582 to adorn a fountain is arranged so that the dwarf's body, which I show you here, it's now in the Bargello, so the dwarf's body can only be perceived kinesthetically, that is, by walking around it atop the fountain. The snail, although cast for the fountain, is not Bronzino's, and it rather interrupts that sense of being led around the figure. As in Bronzino's portrait, the dwarf is shown intent upon his activity. Here he is fishing. Morgante's arms and legs are sinuously akimbo as he casts his line, posed somewhat precariously and composed in counterbalancing and spiraling diagonals. He is not divisible into simple fractions of front and back. On the other hand, at first glance, the design of the statuette of Morgante here at the V&A almost seems to concede the point about the adequacy of two views to create three-dimensional bodies. The pose of the sculpture is close to that in the painting, although he has a different activity. He has a stick to lean on, and he's blowing a horn. Without the dramatic centrifugal movement that we saw in the fishing Morgante, or so many other of Gian Bologna's sculptures. But on closer inspection, it becomes clear that the eye, and in this case the hand, for this figurine must have been meant to be handled. It's 13 centimeters tall, and you do really want to touch it, need not come to rest on one side or the other. In fact, they actually, in a way, cannot. Subtle cues prompt a revolving view, signaling the space around and between the elements that you see, the turn of the head and the sort of flow of the horn, the slightly more raised arm than the position, the rounding position of the arm, which is different from the Bronzino, the bent stick and the moving legs, the crooked contrapposto of the back, the turn of the head and the torso, and the horn, all these turns, subtle turns, are all reinforced by the implicit command of the integrally cast circular base, the base that was cast as this circular, which denies a fixed viewpoint. Monumental, which actually Bronzino's painting is, or miniature, as is the sculpture, although they're both being shown to you much magnified, both pictorial and sculptural representations of Morgante call upon the beholder to appreciate a well-wrought monster, finding perfection in proportioned deformity. A joking epitaph for the dwarf described him as having the nature and appearance of man, beast, fish, and fowl, so ugly that he seemed beautiful. Bronzino's fellow court artist, Giorgio Vasari, took a similar line in appreciating the painted Morgante's success in portraying the dwarf's fantastically monstrous body, his stravaganza di membra mostruose, to make a beautiful and marvelous picture. Those are his terms, beautiful and marvelous picture of its kind. Its kind, as various passages in Vasari's Lives of the Artist proves, was capricious, capriccioso, and bizarre. In the 16th century, marvel and wonder were accepted or even cultivated categories of aesthetic response, to be generated by the beholder's experience of things rare and miraculous. Morgante's was a monstrous body in nature, rendered marvelous by art, which had its own monsters indeed. In the psychological definitions of the time, there were also people defined as monsters of talent. Those, our friend Benedetto Varchi said in a lecture on the subject of monsters, so monsters were a current topic of discussion, those who greatly exceed all others in those works, these are monsters of talents, who almost seem to conquer nature, that is doing something that cannot be ordinarily done by others, Michelangelo among them. The case of Morgante demonstrates how the lowly backside could be dignified by art and academic debate. Indeed, it can be asserted that by the early 16th century, the back view had become a subject of serious study, subject and object of serious study, and even, as we move in the century, of artistic self-identification. A portrait engraving of the sculptor Baccio Bandinelli, the engravings dated 1548, the design may be somewhat earlier, shows him surrounded by the apparatus and results of his art, sketch models and statuettes of the sort that delighted his patron, Duke Cosimo. He was also at the court with Bronzino and eventually Giambologna. Framed by a female figure of generic grace, suitable to become a Venus or a Leda, and a Hercules, Bandinelli's heroic pose is loosely based on Michelangelo's prophets. Here I show you the Bandinelli print and the Ezekiel from the Sistine ceiling. As his position between pedestals, I mean, positioning himself, framing himself this way, also has a Michelangelo-esque air. There was hardly a more image-conscious artist in Cosimo's court. An able self-publicist, oh dear, turn myself off. Can we have the slides back? Thank you. I do like Bandinelli. I didn't really want to censor him, although he is a difficult character and was no friend of my friend Vasari's, but that was unfair to him. Anyways, he was very, very able self-publicist and a constant self-portraitist. Here his pose is rhetorical and monumental. Grandiose in dress and demeanor, he looks out as though engaging with the viewer, grasping the Hercules behind him and gesturing over the statuette and fragments at his feet. These, he seems to say, are the materials and product of my skill, my fortitude, that lion at his feet indeed. As though the completed figures on their bases, shown in varied viewpoints, had been raised from the almost abject array of torsos on the floor. In their turned, twisted, and foreshortened positions, these trunks, those in the foreground, are an array of the difficulties, complicated postures, to be mastered and assimilated into a modern language of excellence. Another torso is featured in the foreground of the print of the Academy of Baccio Bandinelli, published a few years before the portrait engraving. A contentious courtier, Bandinelli was an assiduous teacher, and this engraving publishes his belief in his profession as a learned profession. His school is an academy, it's not a workshop. A skeleton of the rib cage, backbone upwards, is counter or juxtaposed to the sculpted figure, to this trunk next to it. Nature and art brought into, and once again in the foreground here on the right, they're sort of brought in to close proximity, nature and art. The truncated figure's counterweighted pose that emphasizes the curve of the back, the turned head, and taut buttocks recur in the statuette in the portrait print and were realized in a way, this sort of similar pose, in marble in the Naked Prophet, conspicuously, if somewhat enigmatically, placed between two heavily draped prophets in a relief panel made for the choir of the cathedral, made for Bandinelli for the Duomo choir. Exposed as he is, the identity of this sculpted figure is somewhat obscure. It is as though one of Michelangelo's Sistine ignudi has risen to stretch his legs. Whatever else, the backward aspect of all three, the torso from the Academy print, the back view of the statuette from the self-portrait print, and the sculpted nude, three reveal a leitmotif for Bandinelli and can be used as a sign or read of as a sign of the engagement with the physicality as an aesthetic expression, because of course what you don't have is the psychology of someone facing you. In his measured but critically barbed account of Bandinelli in The Lives, Giorgio Vasari gives an unusually positive review of Baccio's statue of Orpheus in the Medici Palace courtyard. Vasari and Baccio were rivals for Cosimo's attention at the court. Vasari comments that in this work, Bandinelli imitated that Apollo of Belvedere at Rome, and it was very highly praised, and rightly, because although the Orpheus of Baccio is not in the attitude of the Apollo Belvedere, nevertheless, it reproduces very successfully the manner of the torso and of all the members. The maniera del torso, the manner of the torso, is a key phrase here and a keen observation. If one recalls the torsos, the torsi, strewn in the foreground of Baccio's portrait, he was very attentive to the maniera del torso. The direction of Vasari's description is of equal note. The similarity between the statues, between the Orpheus of Bandinelli and the Apollo Belvedere, is strongest looking at them from the front. The frontality is significant given the place of the lives in the origins of the modern history of art, and the fact that this forward-facing perspective, this viewing statues from the front, is typical of Vasari's pictorial way of noticing and describing sculpture. A contemporary engraving, which I show you here, suggests that in practice, artists did their best to study the Apollo from more than one angle, not only just looking at it from the front. Antiquity was certainly a source of inspiration for Bandinelli, but there are other sides to the story of the Orpheus. The outstretched cloak of the Orpheus is derived from the Apollo, but Baccio accelerated the rhythm of the folds and the figure's momentum, evoking the urgency of Orpheus's journey to the underworld. The heightened drama of the back view, the greater movement that Baccio gives to the back view here, I think was inspired by Bandinelli's study of Michelangelo's cartoon for a mural of the Battle of Cascina, left in the Palazzo della Signoria in 1505 when Michelangelo departed for Rome. The painting, commissioned for the Hall of the Great Council, was never executed, as many of you well know, owing to Michelangelo's service to the Pope in Rome and the fall of the Florentine government that had ordered the painting. The remaining cartoon became, as many said, a school for artists, Bandinelli among the most zealous. Later destroyed, the cartoon is known from a grisaille painted by Aristotele da San Gallo, now at Holkham Hall, and I show you a detail of it here. Michelangelo's composition showed soldiers lounging by a river, caught unprepared for battle, notionally located in the distance beyond them, many of them looking inwards, facing from behind. The foreground, witnessed by the beholder, is one of twisting bodies, as the torpor of the summer's day is transformed into battle-ready action, largely conveyed through the faceless physicality of muscle-bound figures turning away. In the Orpheus, Bandinelli acknowledged what he learned from Michelangelo about physical eloquence. The cartoon also gave him ample opportunity to take lessons in Michelangelo's Maniera del Torso. If this cartoon was a school for artists intrigued by the centrifugal force of the core of the male body, the Sistine ceiling was the university. The Sistine ignudi present a series of themes and variations on the torsion of the torso, many inspired by the truncated figure we call the Belvedere torso, which was identified as Hercules in the Renaissance because of the animal skin attached to it. But Michelangelo is as much a symptom as a cause for the artist's fascination with this mighty fragment of antiquity. The torso was already celebrated in the late 15th century, when it was in the house of a Lombard sculptor living in Rome, where it was recorded in a poem describing the nude body without arms or neck as the most perfect thing ever seen. It was in the Pope's collection by the 1530s, placed in the Vatican sculpture garden, the Belvedere, hence becoming the Belvedere torso. The torso provides an example of the way that the relics of antiquity sparked the figurative imagination of 16th century artists and offered lessons in form and anatomical composition. Frequently drawn by artists coming to Rome to study, the carcass was seen from many angles. The Dutch artist Martin van Heemskerk, for example, drew it as he found it lying on the ground in the Vatican, as though the torso was struggling to get up, a sort of turtle trying to stand up. This is a drawing in Berlin from his sketchbook. He actually also studied it from other sides. Heemskerk's fellow countryman, Hendrik Goltzius, explored the torso in its upright position from the front and from the side, and they reproduced one in black. They're both actually in red chalk, and they're now in the museum in Harlem, the Tyler's Museum. The Florentine painter, Francesco Morandini, made it part of a series of variations assembled in his album of studies, now in the Uffizi, framing the Belvedere torso on the bottom and the top right with drawings after a sketch model of a terracotta river god by Michelangelo for the tomb of Lorenzo de' Medici in the new sacristy of San Lorenzo, and also with the female statue of Venus. These drawings that I'm showing you are a small but representative sample of the way that the torso was habitually approached from more than one side, back and front, above and around. Artists went around the torso to study it. As study after ancient sculpture and the statues and sketch models by modern classics, such as Michelangelo, became a regular part of artistic training, the systematic drawing of at least three views, front, back, and side, became common practice. It was through this process of multi-angled study that bodies were brought into representation. Their specific iconography, unknown or secondary to their formal properties and their generic meanings as forceful, graceful, delightfully monstrous, or perfectly proportioned. Time after time, we find curious artists looking askew at famous works, such as Raphael, who took a backward investigation of Michelangelo's David. This is the drawing in the British Museum, and the David is installed in the Accademia in Florence. Michelangelo's giant, recently placed after some deliberation in front of the government's palace, and indeed placed on a plinth that was also part of the deliberation. The young Umbrian, that is Raphael, chose a vantage point that neglected the hero's vigilant gaze with its civic resonance to explore the formal possibilities of the stance. The contrast between the patron's placement and the artist's perception of statuary in these cases is not unusual and is consequential. As the amassing of antiquities accelerated in both pace and prestige, collections were increasingly organized as aesthetic displays conveying messages about status and power. Here another drawing by Heemskerk, this time of the view of the courtyard of Casa Sassi. The drawing is in Berlin. This was the house of an ancient Roman family whose assemblage of statues was a form of pedigree of ancient statues in their courtyard. Set into tabernacles, as you can see, or framed as though through windows, finestrelle as they were called, these statues were fragments. As you can see, there's a nice torso there in the background. They became finestrelle, they sort of presented pictures of prestige. The preeminent and probably most influential instance of such programmatic organization was Pope Julius's statue court, the Cortile delle Statue, the statue court, in the Vatican. There, as one visitor described in a letter dated 1512, the Pope gathered antique statues, the letter says, procured from the Roman ruins where they were recently discovered, and placed them each on its little altar. And I show you, the Belvedere program was modified by successive popes who inflected it according to their tastes and to the cultural politics of the time. But I'm showing you a drawing, which probably was a drawing for the niche intended to receive the Laocoon, so part of the original Belvedere project. And of course, the Laocoon was one of the most spectacular of those discoveries. And it recalls the way that Julius wanted to have his trophies enshrined. and a mid-16th century guidebook to the ancient statues of Rome calls these spaces chapels. So we have chapels, we have little windows, we have these ways of framing and sacralizing these fragments and these famous statues and fragments of antiquity. The Belvedere installation was a trendsetter. What followed was not so much a niche market as a market for niches. As seen, for example, in the palace of Cardinal Andrea della Valle, which he made into a show place for the exhibiting of the family's antiquities in the second and third decades of the 16th century, as recalled here and publicized, indeed, in a contemporary print. The della Valle collection was later dispersed, but its scheme with statues framed and frontally disposed in symmetrical patterns was frequently repeated, for example, in the Roman palaces of the Farnese and of Cardinal Fernando de' Medici, who acquired actually many of the della Valle statues. Impressed by what he saw in Rome, our friend Duke Cosimo de' Medici created an exhibition space for his antiquarium, a damask-lined room of niches, really called the Sala delle Nicchie, in Palazzo Pitti in Florence. These installations supplied definitive models of how to arrange and how to appreciate great sculptural works, both ancient and modern. Their schemes of decorative array and iconographic association were followed in subsequent displays that staged sculptural viewing in monumental architecture with impressive vistas punctuated by framed masterworks. Modern temples of taste were built on these precedents. The creation, for example, of the Archaeological Museum in the Vatican, the still extant Museo Pio Clementino, is a prime example of this heritage and of its working out through the history of display. Begun in 1770 in the pontificate of Clemente XIV, it was completed under Pius VI, hence its name, Pio Clementino. And I show you some prints of the museum. The grandeur of the setting was intended to evoke the original environment of the works and also to inspire the awe that they merited. What can be called the Belvedere model not only provided a canonical pattern of presentation for sculpture, but it also influenced the conventions of representation. The development of these displays was accompanied by their publication in a developing market of reproductive prints. So just in the mid-16th century, as we get these canonical pictorializing or framing displays, we also begin to have an industry or market of reproductive printmaking. Here, I show you the our friend, the Apollo Belvedere, in a print dated 1553 from Antonio Lafreri's Speculum Romanae Magnificentiae. Lafreri did not publish a book on Rome. He produced prints of its major monuments that could be gathered according to taste under the cover of a title page. While the illustration of the Apollo in the Vatican recollected its actual position there, raised on a pedestal in a niche, this framing was used by Lafreri for other Belvedere statues that were not in niches, as well as statues in other collections, such as the Hercules in the Farnese courtyard, which we know from a drawing of the courtyard. So you see it appears in one of Lafreri's niches. It's become a niched statue. But we know from a drawing on the left by Annibale Carracci as he approached the statue in the Farnese courtyard, and from Heinrich Goltzius' looming vision of the Hercules Farnese, it could certainly be seen very differently. It was not a niched sculpture, and it could be encountered quite dramatically coming from behind. But the format is symbolic, that of the niche. The reserved space of the niche and the elevation of the statue define the viewing experience as a perspective in terms of a perspective respectful distance. The albums and books of prints illustrating statues in Rome and elsewhere that circulated from the mid-16th to the early 19th century generally adopted this frontal code, literally turning the statues into icons. Broadly speaking, these conventional views became canonical in the 19th century. They were transferred to the new medium of photography by the major photographic agencies, such as Alinari and Brogi, and this is conspicuously in an Alinari photograph in Italy. At this point, and what's interesting about this Alinari photo, it is taken, and I took it on purpose, from the website, because Alinari is still selling. This is a 19th century photograph. The two Apollo Belvederes, they sell on their website. One's from the 1860s and one's from the 1890s, just to say how canonical these views have become in art history. In these photographs, in such photography, the frontal view of sculpture took on explicitly documentary value, guaranteeing the scientific objectivity of the images. In addition to supplying the commonplace vision of Italian sculpture, of Roman and Italian sculpture, for the many tourists who took home these prints as souvenirs, you'd regularly go to Alinari and buy your prints and photographs, the photo agency images were rapidly assimilated into the academic discipline of art history as the basis for research and publication and formed the core of the photographic archives that we study from today. At the turn of the 20th century, when Heinrich Wuflin, one of the founding fathers of academic art history, addressed the question of how one should photograph sculpture, the title of one of his articles, the answer was literally straightforward. For the classic sculpture of antiquity and the Renaissance, he advocated the direct frontal view, maintaining that this was the principal view. Wuflin's prescriptions can be taken as paradigmatic of the general and deeply rooted frontal approach to the representation of sculpture that persists to our day. And I will add as a footnote, two footnotes here, not only that Alinari is still selling photographs from its 19th century stock, I had to ask Peter Mathieu to commission a back view of the Giambologna Morgante, which did not exist for the V&A. And indeed, looking at Anthony Gormley's website, I was struck by the fact that nearly 90% of his works are shown frontally. So here you go. The traditions of installation and of reproduction I have outlined here are, of course, more varied and their history much more complicated than my summary account allows. But I don't think that the main lines of either are terribly distorted by my synoptic account. The argument is that the institutionalization of Renaissance sculpture, as collected, arranged, and published over time, has tended to tame some of its more unruly aspects. I show you Donatello's fetching Amorino in the Bargello as a literally cheeky instance of an artist's teasing use of the backside. As noted earlier, the sidedness of sculpture was in the forefront of discussions of its specific qualities and relative merits in the 16th century. Artists like Giambologna provided virtuoso demonstrations of a sculptor's power to make his materials mobile. Here I show you, you will experience this when you take a walk around the Samson slaying a Philistine downstairs in the sculpture gallery, which is a series of worth such a perambulation because of all the delights that it offers you as you go around it. By way of a concluding case, however, or coda to my discussion here, I'm going to offer you a statue not here in the V&A, but one in the Bargello. This is a statue that goes by the title of Honor Overcoming Deceit. It was made by the Perugian sculptor Vincenzo Danti in 1561. His patron was one of Duke Cosimo's most ambitious, so we're back in the ambient of Duke Cosimo and the Medici court of the mid-16th century, but his patron was one of Cosimo's most ambitious as well as most artistically inclined courtiers, his chamberlain, a man named Sforza Almeni. Danti, Vincenzo Danti, the sculptor, coming from outside of Florence, wanted or needed to attract the Duke's attention. I've told you before with Bandinelli and Vasari, it was a very, very competitive atmosphere. There's a lot of competition being incited and inspired quite purposely by the Duke, but a lot of things going on, but you really had to catch the eye of the Duke and the Duchess. Anyway, he really wanted to, he needed to do this, and he needed to do this. Dante needed to catch his eye with a virtuoso work. How better than with a complicated figure group carved from one block of marble, and that is also important, virtuoso activity. The compression of Dante's composition simultaneously emphasized and defied its stony boundaries. Attentive to fashionable elements of delight, Dante carved a beautiful torso and juxtaposed the idealized and directionally superior youth, the youth on top, with the contorted and crumpled form of his inferior, aged foe. Marvelously, thus bringing marvel into play, pitting the manly against the monstrous. Themes of conquest were pleasing to the powers that be at the time, then as they must be now, so that he had a good theme, he had a marble carved from one block, he did things in a varied way, he pitted, made them marvelous. In this case, the entwinement of the figures in combat is materialized by a tie that binds them. There's a tie, if you start looking, you'll see there's a thread, a band that binds them, wrapping over and around them. It is the thread that must be followed to try to unwind or comprehend the moral of the story. Leading around the group, it compromises an easy resolution and makes it impossible formally to see the action from any one vantage point. Taken frontally, honor's victory is secure. But as we move around the figure, there is a strangely ironic twist, and the struggle seems to increase. The struggling figure, and indeed the struggling figure of deceit, is giving honor a kick up the backside. In the Tuscan vernacular, as I say, well known to people at the time, kicking someone up the ass is to mock or to deceive them. Was Dante giving the last word to deceit in this sculpture? If so, it was prophetic. 5 years after the sculpture was completed as the centerpiece of his palace courtyard, Sforza Almeni was strangled by Duke Cosimo with his own hands in circumstances still shrouded in mystery. So I leave you with that. Thank you. And I guess I invite Antonio to come forward to converse.
The last time I was in this extraordinary and beautiful auditorium was to hear Joseph Beuys, so that was a long time ago. Thank you for a really enlightening lecture. I think that last image was absolutely wonderful, and it reminds me of Epstein's Lazarus in Oxford, in New College, Oxford. The way that a band can, the opposite of constricting, actually give a certain kind of energy. And the way that distortion that is created through the acknowledgement of the original block, which is true of both that and Michelangelo's Slaves, somehow gives a kind of compressed energy. But I wasn't aware of that work.
Well, and those who know Michelangelo and have thought about the sculpture more than I will know that that is a direct comparison. I mean, Dante, as I said, being ambitious and needing to insert himself, as I say, the one block thing was one of the sine qua nons. The understanding the struggling figure was going to be another, but also the looking at the victorious torso, the victorious, you know, there's also Michelangelo's victory. Which in a niche in the Salone di Cinquecento, so there's a lot of that thinking is going on. But then thinking around, which I think is what...
But it's intriguing that, I don't know if you're aware, but I did an installation in the Hermitage, and that is Otto von Klenzer interior that absolutely mirrors the Farnese or the Medici model of a courtyard with originally 27 plinthed works, all pushed to the edges of the room. It was Dionysus room, and the Dionysus group also was pushed to the side in the center of the room, and a lion sculpture took up the center of the space, which actually used it the least. And I released four of the sculptures that were originally in the room and brought another five from other parts of the museum and put them on the ground and then raised the floor up so that the viewer was literally on the same level as the sculpted antique. And it was a wonderful thing. And and it was wonderful to see how people actually started to move themselves in that room in a very different way. That kinesthesia that you talked about, the fact that actually you were encouraged to move in a, not through the room, but round it, that you were encouraged to make comparisons between one work and another. And obviously also the be aware in some senses of your own body size in relation to, I think, a range of scales. In that case, there was an Athena that was about 1.5 times life size, and an Eros that was somewhat less than life size. And it was wonderful to see people, standing between the two and, in a way, sensing their own scale as the intermediary.
Well, and I read the essay that you wrote about that, and also the point that you make elsewhere about the putting things on levels. Two things about levels that struck me in reading. One is the democratization, the fact of taking the sculpture off the plinth, which is, one thought I had, is about, what does the plinth do? The notion of perspectives, and then the relationship of the viewer to the statue. Mm. And what I was wondering, however, about this question of, the embodied viewer encountering the body of the sculpture. So one way you say that is different is to, put them on the same level, encourage a kind of intimacy. But as an embodied viewer of a Giambologna, which also makes you want to walk around, and as a sculptor, what then is your definition of the difference of that experience?
Well, I think that sculpture is a thing in the world, amongst other things, and what one wants is to be aware of the fact that you have a displacement. And once you use a plinth to frame or remove the object from, as it were, the common ground of collective experience, you remove one of its primary potentials. And for me, the joy is to sense in one's own freedom of movement, one's own ability to investigate, to project, and to release the objectness into some kind of functionality. And I guess that's the thing that struck me in your lecture was how in many senses, in the exercising of the power of the patron to make these extraordinary collections like the Farnese collection or indeed the Medici collection itself, in a sense these things were used as trophies and placed within the framing of a niche or a window surround. And that's a demonstration really of the power of the patron to make this demonstration of wealth and obviously the power of acquisition, but also in some way to put you into the position of a gazer onto a marvel, rather than an inquirer into a phenomena. And my work has tried very, I think, consistently to suggest that the reflexive has to replace the representational. I like the idea that a sculpted body is a displacement of space in human form that in some way confronts our embodiment with something that exists in another register of time, however, is coexistent with us in space. And I think for me, that's the most powerful thing that you can use the inherent qualities of sculpture for. What is sculpture? It is still and it is silent. How do you allow those qualities to somehow challenge our loquacity and our constant movement? And I think you do it most powerfully by putting the living body and the made body into the closest possible position of dialogue. And that means a shared level. But I've used the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square to do the opposite and think about how that idea of elevated values and an elevated frame in some way reinforces the representational and the idealized nature of sculpture, and that's what the Fourth Plinth Project One Another was about. And yeah, for me that was an intriguing experiment, whether or not it had anything to do with sculpture remains to be seen.
Well, the plinth problem, because as I say, I was provoked. One of the things that, once again, is well known to several people here in the installation of the David, which is very interesting. It's one, it's heavily documented. You have this, well, in a typical Florentine way, they had a number of typical things. They had this problem of this big piece of sculpture, stone, which Michelangelo seemed to have solved, but then new problem, what are we going to do with it? And so they convene a committee. I mean, the committee work part is the very characteristic Florentine part. And then the next characteristic Florentine part is all these people getting together and saying very trenchant, observant things. But there's an awareness in the discussion of the passers-by. How will it be seen? I mean, makes it a wonderful conversation. These viandanti, how are they going to see this? How are they going to best see it? And it comes up in that conversation right away, or early in the deliberations, that it's going to be on a plinth, that it's to raise it up so that it can be seen by the passers-by. And then they just discuss different ways, for different reasons, that it should be in different parts of the city as it ends up in front of the government palace. But at one point there is someone who says, well, the passers-by should come to the statue, not the statue to the passers-by. There is some idea of this intersection between who's seeing what at what time. So the visibility under different conditions, but the visibility of sculpture, is a very, people are aware of it. And I guess what makes it an interesting time for me is that I come back to the fact when I was reading what you're saying, that representation is being articulated. People are giving the words to what it is. And maybe it's that it becomes things that should be provoked by certain angles that are different from the things that you provoke by the other spatial organization of your sculpture.
Yeah, I guess I'm interested in elevation to the point where it is no longer on a plinth, but the body in some senses becomes so distant that it measures the place that it's in. So the installation of Event Horizon, which was 31 sculptures, 4 on the ground, and then 27 on rooftops or on building tops, was I guess for myself to experiment with that idea of elevation. But there, I think the dynamic was quite strategic. I wanted to put, so there were two pieces on Waterloo Bridge, for example, placed in the flow of people arriving in the morning to go to work in the city and leaving at night. And their static and silent nature in relation, and nakedness in relation to the dressed flow of humankind was very important. But they also became the touchstones for a kind of looking, a looking again at the environment. And the displaced bodies that were then put on the skyline that you could see but not touch, I think, encouraged people to think, well, where does this invasion of alien bodies stop? So that linked to an imaginative projection of the viewer. And this detachment, I guess, from name, from label, from cultural context, so solid iron bodies on the street, images of bodies that couldn't be touched and therefore didn't have a material, kind of empirical material presence, linked to imaginative bodies that could be anywhere. They didn't have names. They had no purpose. They weren't memorializing anything. They weren't heroic, and it was, I hope, clear that these were, in a way, transposed lived moments into iron or fiberglass. They kind of asked people to, like these ones, to project onto these empty, meaningless, nameless things, feelings that they might have themselves about their lives at the moment, or indeed, you know, bigger questions. Or they might ask, what on earth is this thing doing here on my journey to work or on my journey home? And that possibility of art to provoke, in a way, questioning, projection of the viewer onto, you could say, an open space that happens to be human in form. I think that's of a very different order to the kind of, I suppose, monumentalizing of the classic, the narrative of mythology, the Apollos, the Hercules, the saints, all of the ways in which, I suppose, the body has been used in sculpture to reinforce either sacred or political mythologies or narratives. And that, I guess, the power for me about bringing the body back is that it can confront us with our own embodiedness.
I mean, it seems that the definition, explained in a way, that your terms reflexive and representational and that, because what you were talking about is that projection is the reflexive activity. I guess we'd say that there's no doubt, about the sort of embeddedness of representation in figurative sculpture of the Renaissance, that it is something represented in a whole series of values. Not only a subject, that is a title or something, give it, being shown and being displayed, but displayed with certain recognizable values inside them, which constitutes representation, which constitutes art as representation. I'd agree that. I think that the difference, there's another longer-term difference has to do with how one talks about subjectivity. You're talking about a modern kind of psychologically defined subjectivity. What I think, and this is not so much, I think, in what I talked about this evening, and what interests me about looking, coming from behind and looking at the behind, is a certain way in the way that deceit, the honor and deceit, isn't quite what it seems to be. But I think there are a lot of ambiguous sensations provoked within Renaissance sculpture that have some of those reflexive values that you've sort of heightened the volume on, or made a sort of primary function, as opposed to maybe not a byproduct, because I don't want to say it's byproduct, because it's actually inherent in the forms that are chosen or made or composed.
But I think that's true, I think that all, good art, I think, goes beyond, as it were, the terms of its referent. And certainly that Gem Bologna downstairs, Samson slaying the Philistine. I mean, it's an extraordinary object because it does make us absolutely have to walk around, and in a sense, it calls upon our empathy, exactly like, you know, honor slaying whatever it was, deceit, calls upon our empathy to inhabit those positions. And and when I think, I mean, I don't know whether the works are still there, but I've got two of my concrete pieces at the Academia at the moment, between Michelangelo's slaves, and there's no, I was there not long ago, and there's absolutely no question in my view that what he was trying to do was objectify the very challenge of what sculpture is as a, in a way, a material transfer of what it feels like to inhabit a body. And I mean, there's one piece particularly, which is just before you get to the David on the left-hand side, this sort of, the position is like this raised elbow. And the block has deliberately been left as a kind of restricting border. And it's an extraordinary thing. This is not about, as it were, the summoning of the image of a bound slave. It's about somehow talking about the weight of the body, of, in a way, the thing that I'm interested in, the darkness of the body, the idea of the body as a place of becoming. And, you know, whether these things were ever going to be, you know, Julius II's funerary monument, they became, you know, that may have been the excuse for making them in the first place, but they became something absolutely existential. And I would say the four Pietas of Michelangelo equally, they are a you could say a religious mythological subject matter that he somehow makes his own. And in the Rondanini, the last Pietà, so far as I'm concerned, this is a extraordinary celebration of what sculpture itself is. The evocation of entropy, of the weight of matter, of the relationship of mind to body, the relationship of Mary to the dead Christ is a kind of continuum, an extraordinary celebration, so far as I'm concerned, of what sculpture can do, which is somehow put matter into a confrontation with life. And I guess in some sense is that that's what I'm trying to do here. So these two times is to say this is a transposition of a living body into the state of sculpture in two particular moments. I am challenging the idea of the unique object. I'm engaging the viewer in the idea of looking beyond, as it were, what is represented to a, you could say, invisible horizon or an implied horizon. And I mean, I really thank you for in your lecture, the way that you have, in a sense, reinforced the primal challenge, I think, of making any substitute body, is that it has to have the authority of a body's independence, and that can only be, I think, realized by releasing it from the pictorial, releasing it from all those plinths and niches I've just made a new word, plinth.
Delicious.
releasing it from, in a way, the definition of a pictorial or ideological frame. And I think that your picture researchers should be absolutely thanked for those extraordinary. I mean, that Raphael drawing, I really didn't know of Michelangelo's David, which was a fantastic thing to see.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia and Anthony, for this amazing, first the talk and then the discussion. You gave us fascinating views and perspectives, not only on the male body, but also on Italian Renaissance sculpture and sculpture in general. Thank you all for joining us tonight on the Robert H. Smith Lecture 2012. Please may I ask you to leave the lecture theater by the doors to your left, but not after an applause before. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Independence, and that can only be, realized by releasing it from the pictorial, releasing it from all those plinths and niches. I've just made a new word, plinth.
Delicious.
releasing it from, in a way, the definition of a pictorial or ideological frame. And I think that your picture researchers should be absolutely thanked for those extraordinary. I mean, that Raphael drawing, I really didn't know of Michelangelo's David, which was a fantastic thing to see.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Patricia and Anthony, for this amazing, first the talk and then the discussion. You gave us fascinating views and perspectives, not only on the male body, but also on Italian Renaissance sculpture and sculpture in general. Thank you all for joining us tonight on the Robert H. Smith Lecture 2012. Please may I ask you to leave the lecture theater by the doors to your left, but not after an applause before. Thank you.
Thank you very much.